History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Welcome back, everyone. In the last episode, the war comes to an end. We experience the moment of silence on the 11th minute of the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, and it's over. But as I said at the end of the last episode, this is such a big war that the peace is going to be equally big, and we need to spend some good time focusing on this, because what happens at the end of World War One? If we dig into it and understand it, it can help us make sense of World War II, the rest of the 20th century, and even while there are still conflicts in places in the world like the Balkans and the Middle East today. And a lot of it comes from this peace that's happening. Well, some people called this, tongue-in-cheek a bit, if the World War I was the war to end all wars, this is the peace to end all peace. And we'll see why that makes sense. So
yeah,
what's happening with the Paris Settlement and the Treaty of Versailles?
All right. Well, the leaders of the victorious nations agreed to come together in January of 1919, January 18th to be specific, at the Paris Peace Conference. And it's always get a chuckle, Scott, about how many treaties and how many peace conferences have occurred in Paris. When I teach my students, I'll say like, oh, I'm sorry, but once again, this war ends by the Treaty of Paris. I mean, you think of the French and Indian War ended with a treaty in Paris, the American Revolution, of course, and so many other treaties of Paris. Sometimes if there's one that's not Paris, I'll joke and say, oh, hey, at least it's not Paris. It makes it easier to remember. But of course, Paris is—it's just a great place to do have a peace conference, right, Scott? I mean, can't beat the food; the wine is great.
Yeah, anyway, might as well relax and decompress a bit after being in a trench or in a military tent for several years.
Yeah, and before we get going, I should say Scott and I, as we usually do, are just going to fly over this. We're going to give the 10,000-foot view, a very brief overview. This is an incredibly complicated subject, this peace, just the peace conference alone and the settlements. Entire books have been written about this, and there's so many moving parts, but we are just going to give you the Cliff Notes version, if you will. So if you want more, obviously feel free to read more about the topic, but it's a fascinating subject. So the Paris Peace Conference had as their task the writing of 5 separate peace treaties with the defeated separate powers. Everybody knows about the Treaty of Versailles, but that's not the only treaty. In fact, that's just 1 of 5. That's the most famous one, of course, because it deals with Germany, but the Treaty of Versailles itself did not end the war formally. You had to have treaties with all of the central powers. So they had to deal not just with Germany, but with Turkey, Bulgaria, Austria, and Hungary. Hungary, of course, and Austria are separate nations now. The Habsburg Empire, also known as the Austro-Hungarian Empire, is no more. In this peace conference, there were 27 nations that participated. 10,000 people attended, so it's massive. The defeated central powers, however, were not allowed to participate.
I wonder if that'll lead to some sour grapes.
It just might, yeah. Mistake number one of many, many mistakes that the Allies are going to make. Don't even let the Germans have a place at the table. That's going to come back and bite them in the butt later. But again, that's another subject. Okay, the Germans and the other Central Power nations don't get any say in what happens. The terms are just going to be dictated to them. Russia was not even allowed to come. The Soviet Union, or the soon-to-be Soviet Union, was seen as a rogue nation. They were an illegitimate regime in the eyes of the Allies. And in fact, even as this is going on, the Allies have troops fighting against the Bolsheviks in Russia, which to me is another fascinating topic I'd love to explore someday, but not today. It is not this day, as Aragon says in the movie. Okay, so the proceedings at the Paris Peace Conference were dominated by the so-called Big Four, and that would be the leaders of France, Britain, the United States, and Italy. France was led by Prime Minister Clemenceau, Georges Clemenceau, the Tiger, and he is extremely anti-German. He wants to stick it to the Germans. He wants to punish them. And it's understandable when you consider that so much of the fighting was done in France.
The terms you'll see are not at all favorable to German. Clemenceau wanted to make it worse than what happened, if you can believe it. So just keep that in mind.
Yeah, I mean, he wanted to carve out pieces of Germany. He wanted to break up the German Empire if possible. But of course, Britain and the U.S. are not going to go for that. They were at least wise enough to realize that the future of Europe needed a stable Germany. We're not going to go back to the days when Germany was like, 300 small principalities and duchies and things like that. We need to have a Germany, but we're going to trim them down a little bit here. Of course, obviously, Clemenceau negotiated with a stubborn dedication to defend French interests and to obtain French security for the future. And that's totally understandable. You know, if you get punched in the face by somebody, you're going to do everything you can to make sure you don't get punched again. France really, the French nation had perhaps suffered more than any other major power. You could certainly argue Belgium on a percentage, you know, or I don't know, on a relative scale, Belgium also suffered greatly, but France, the French countryside was devastated. France had lost millions of men. So Clemenceau he wants to really make sure that never happens again. Britain was led by their prime minister, David Lloyd George. He tried to compromise when possible, but he was also determined to primarily defend his nation's interest. He wanted to make sure the British Empire stayed the British Empire and did not get diminished as the other empires are going to do. Italy, of course, Italy was kind of the junior partner in the alliance. They were represented by their prime minister, Vittorio Orlando. He wanted a major place at the table, but the French and British leaders didn't, and even Wilson, they're not going to take him very seriously. He was very frustrated by his fellow allies' lack of interest in getting Adriatic ports for Italy. And so he stormed out of the negotiations on April 4th, changing the Big Four to the Big Three. And of course, the fourth one or third one, once Italy's out, is the U.S. And the U.S. was represented primarily by President Wilson. And this is, people don't understand how revolutionary this was, Scott. President Wilson was the first U.S. president to leave the country while he was president. People told him, don't go. You don't need to go personally. Send the Secretary of State. I mean, that's what you would normally do. That was the Secretary of State's job, to represent the U.S. in diplomatic negotiations. But Wilson, as we've seen, had a very high view of himself, saw himself as God's chosen instrument to bring peace to the world. And so there was no way he wasn't going to be there. He wanted to bring about a new international order among idealistic lines. He was incredibly idealistic, not terribly realistic. And he had a lot of noble goals, but he didn't quite understand how, I guess, angry the Europeans were at Germany. I say the Europeans, I mean France, Britain. Wilson, when he arrived in Europe, he was enthusiastically greeted by Europeans, including 2 million French people. They lined up in the streets as his car passed by, shouting, Wilson, Wilson, or Viva Wilson. Many Europeans called for a Wilson peace, and he promoted his 12 points in the League of Nations. We talked about the, 14 points. The 14, I just cut two of them off. Sorry, Wilson. But he promoted his 14 points and, of course, the League of Nations, which was the crown jewel of the 14 points. Now, time was crucial. The military situation was changing. Even though there had been an armistice, there was not peace all over Europe, not by any stretch of the imagination. There were still isolated pockets of fighting. There were rebellions rising up. A lot of Germans were declaring themselves socialists or even communists. Other nations were having border disputes, fighting. It would take us a long time just to list all the different groups that were fighting. So they needed to hurry up and come up with a permanent solution. Plus, the negotiators were being constantly lobbied by people from many nations trying to get their demands met. For example, one one nation that had a representative was Vietnam. Vietnam was at the time part of what was called French Indochina, dominated by France, of course, ruled by France. And there was a young man who came to the negotiations hoping to achieve Vietnamese independence. His name was Ho Chi Minh. Perhaps our listeners have heard of him. He will also have a big future in many ways. But Ho Chi Minh, like many of the leaders from these smaller colonial nations, were basically completely ignored by the big three. Okay, Scott, what else?
Well, I think the people there at the conference, they felt the pressure because there hadn't been a peace agreement like this in, I would say, a century since the Treaty of Berlin after the Napoleonic Wars, that more or less hammered out the borders of what Europe was for an entire century. And it maintained more or less, and I have to throw that in a lot, a peace for an entire century. Of course, there's Franco-Prussian War, Crimean War, and other things, but nothing huge like World War One. The biggest treaty before that was the Treaty of Westphalia in 1648 after the 30 Years' War between Catholics and Protestants. And that established the rights of sovereignty, that you can't simply go into another nation and demand that they do things the way you want them to do just because you have power and just because you have armies. I mean, thankfully, we take that for granted for the most part. And a lot of people still don't do that today, but they at least give lip service to that. That's after the Treaty of Westphalia. And the feeling there is what happens at this conference is going to dictate Europe and also many of the borders of the world for the next century. We have to do this right. We have to lobby our side hard because we could be at a disadvantaged and weakened state for the next century or maybe even completely annihilated. And like James said, all of this is happening at a time when there's not peace. Many of the crown heads of Europe had been deposed after World War One. The Tsar and his family of Russia had been murdered. The Kaiser was in exile. The Bavarian king Ludwig III had fallen to a socialist revolt. Austria and Hungary declared themselves republics.
Russia's in a civil war.
Right, Russia's in a civil war. Charles I of the Austro-Hungarian Empire is an emperor without an empire.
Yeah.
He goes to exile. These nations that existed from the deep past, like Latvia, Estonia, Finland, and Poland, are reemerging. There's communist flags that are popping up all over the place, wondering if there's going to be revolutions there. There are German mercenary armies fighting Bolsheviks in Germany. And some of these mercenaries are trying to annex the Baltic states, trying to do what the Teutonic Knights did before. But overall, one point I want to make is that the leaders of the Allies, Clemenceau, Lloyd George, or Wilson, they don't seem to have the mind they're going to do what the heads of state at the Treaty of Berlin in 1815 are doing. They're not trying to restore world order like those leaders did and make for a long peace. And to the to the credit of Wellington and others in 1815, they did make a peace that lasted a long time. The goal of Wilson and others is to recreate the world order, to have international institutions that can prevent a terrible war like this happening. And again, let's give Wilson the benefit of the doubt that he wanted to make a world order so that something like World War One would not happen again. Because if they're just going to restore things, well, what's going to prevent things from happening again? And exactly do a great job on that front. But
the very fact that we refer to this as World War One kind of gives it away, doesn't it?
What can we say? They tried, listeners. They tried.
Yeah. And, you know, they were, as I mentioned, the big three, big four at first, and then big three were besieged by people from smaller nations like Vietnam and others, the Czechs, hundreds of these nations that were there to lobby for their own independence and their own national self-determination. And they were doing things like literally slipping pieces of paper under the hotel doors, like the door to their hotel room, slipping them under the doors of Wilson and Clemenceau and Lloyd George. And yeah, and another interesting anecdote I read in one of the sources is that, well, first of all, Lloyd George and Clemenceau and Wilson, in some cases, they didn't even know these countries existed. You know, like, I mean, they knew who the Czechs were, but some others, like Ruthenians, who were they? And there's a story, a famous story of Edith Wilson, President Wilson's wife, second wife.
Later, basically the president.
Yeah, right. The first female president. But again, that's another story. You can look it up, though. But anyway, for now, Wilson is actually in fairly decent health. But Edith Wilson went to the conference with Woodrow Wilson. And at one point, she walked into a room. She was looking for Wilson. And she walked into this room and she sees in the middle of the room, literally on their knees, Wilson and Lloyd George and Clemenceau on their knees, poring over a gigantic map of Europe that was on the floor. And she said something like, "You look like little boys playing a game," or something. I mean, they're like, "Okay, can you imagine, Scott? Okay, so the Estonians have sent a note saying they want independence." And the first thing is like, where's Estonia? Let's find it. And
yeah, I mean, you're thinking, well, let's give them this. Oh, but then we're going to move this border. Oh, yeah, because that violates a treaty from 40 years ago.
Right.
There's so many moving parts. The best analogy I can think of are those cornball time travel episodes of Star Trek of, well, you do this and then it causes a butterfly effect that affects all these other things, too. I shouldn't say cornball. I mean, some of the best episodes like City on the Edge of Forever, the original series, were time travel. But to get out of the nerdery, listeners, this is horrifyingly complex, and I think they're starting to realize what they're getting into with all these treaties.
Yeah, and again, they realize the decisions they make, the boundaries they set, are going to impact lives of hundreds of millions of people, and inevitably, there's going to be people that end up in the wrong country. There's just no way to... What would you do? Go by the county, you know, like every single county, take a vote. Which country do you want to be in? And in fact, they're going to deny some people the right to be in the country they want to be in. We'll talk about this a little later, but the Austrians actually wanted to be joined with Germany, kind of a voluntary Anschluss before the actual Anschluss. But they were denied that because the big three did not want Germany to be so powerful and so large. But anyway, we could talk a long time about this. There's so much, as I said before, so many fascinating stories and so much complexity. But let's go ahead and move on to the first treaty, the big treaty, the Versailles Treaty.
Hey, everyone. Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
Okay. Ready, Scott?
Let's do it.
Let's do it. All right. So the Treaty of Versailles was massive. It had 440 articles. And at this time, I'm going to recite all 440. So we'll be done in 3 hours. Just kidding. Here are the most important ones, though. Let's talk about the ones that were key. First of all, Germany would lose all of its colonies around the world and about 13% of its pre-war European territory. And that's about 10% of its population. If you look at a map of Germany before World War I and after World War I, you'll see that it goes on a diet, so to speak. It's going to get smaller. Lost territories included Alsace and Lorraine, which we've talked about many times.
Charlemagne smiles.
I know. They're still fighting over that 1,100 years later. The Germans, of course, didn't like that. They protested, saying, well, those are territories that we rightfully stole from the French. But in fact, it's a long and complicated history. But anyway, they go back to France. Germany loses a little bit of land near Belgium, near Denmark, and eastern territories that were awarded to the new state of Poland. Poland had been basically divvied up by Austria and Russia and Germany. The partitioning, I guess, of Poland is the way it's called. But now Poland is going to reemerge as a free and independent state, and it's going to have a corridor to the Baltic. If you look at a map, you'll see that part of Germany, which is called East Prussia, is cut off from the rest. The city of Danzig, or Gdansk in Polish, I don't know if I said that right, but close enough, is actually in between two parts of Germany. So I would not want to live in that city, like be between Germany and Germany. But anyway, if I didn't explain that clearly, just check out a map, folks. You'll see that Germany has one little section, East Prussia, which is discontinuous from the rest of Germany.
And Hitler in World War II, one of the very first things he does is to recapture Gdansk and rename it Danzig.
Right.
A lot of symbolism in that city.
Yeah, that creates, needless to say, a very unstable situation. So in addition to territorial losses, Germany's armed forces were to be limited to 100,000 men. You know, that's teeny weeny by World War I standards. And conscription was forbidden. The Rhineland was to be demilitarized. And keep in mind, this is part of Germany. So Germany's told you can't even have soldiers and military gear in this major chunk of your own country. The West Bank of the Rhine would be occupied by the Allies for 15 years. Of course, Clemenceau had actually wanted an independent Rhineland state, but this was denied. That was going too far, it was felt, by England and, I mean, I should say, not England, Great Britain or the UK, technically, and America. But here's the big one. Germany was forced to pay war reparations, and the sum was later, at first, they basically had to sign a blank check, but later the sum was set at $31 billion. In 1921 dollars. That's, I don't know how much that would be today, maybe 10 times that much. But Wilson was opposed to this idea. Wilson realized that requiring them to pay this much money was going to be a major problem. You know, what if the economy tanks? That'll never happen, right? The economy will always be strong. Anyway.
And if you're curious, what? Listeners, I have an episode about the German economic miracle. The point being that after World War II, they learned the lessons, well, all the mistakes they make after World War I. Because, yeah, this spoiler is not good. It tanks Germany's economy. It leads to hyperinflation and all sorts of other things that lead to the rise of a not-so-nice party in the 1930s. And so these war reparations, bad idea.
Yeah. Wilson eventually had to give in to it, by the way, of course. And then finally, and this is really more insult than anything else, Germany was given, well, actually, this is not finally, and there's still more after this, but this is an interesting thing. Germany was given commercial limitations. There were certain things they couldn't do with trade and manufacturing. For example, they could not use the terms cognac and champagne for their products. So it's just kind of... You're not allowed to have German champagne. Doggone it, if it says champagne, it has to be from the Champagne region of France. And here is another one. I guess this is the final article that I'm going to mention. And this is maybe, and I don't know, I don't think it's more problematic than the money, the reparations, but this is highly problematic in the German viewpoint. And that is Article 231, which was later called the War Guilt Clause. This required Germany to accept full and complete blame for the war. And as you can imagine, the Germans howled over this. They said, what? You're gonna pin this entire thing on us. It's entirely our fault. Of course, it was not. I personally think it was largely Germany's fault, but there's no way you could say it was completely Germany's fault. But again, Germany was in no position to argue. They had to give in to this. They had to accept the terms before the blockade would be lifted, even though the armistice had been signed, the blockade had been maintained by the British, and the Germans were still starving. So really, they had the Germans over a barrel, Scott. They were negotiating from a position of complete weakness. All right, so the treaty was signed on June 19th, 1919, exactly 5 years after the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand, and it was signed in the Hall of Mirrors, which had been part of the palace, was part of the Palace of Versailles, which I believe, if I remember correctly, Louis XIV had built way back. This was also where the formation of the German Empire had been declared in 1871. So it's kind of revenge on the part of the French. We're going to sign this same place where you guys started all this mess, at least in the German, I mean, in the French point of view. One other thing I want to mention is that German reaction to the treaty was one of shock, followed by outrage. Germans called it a dictated peace, and to be honest, they were right. The war guilt clause was especially offensive. However, the terms, we have to say this, as tough as the Treaty of Versailles was on Germany, it wasn't anywhere near as tough as the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk that we talked about in a previous episode. That when Germany dictated terms to Russia, they were a lot harsher terms even than what was dictated at the Treaty of Versailles. All right. So the Germans were being maybe slightly hypocritical here when they were protesting how tough the Treaty of Versailles was. When it was time to actually sign the treaty, Clemenceau, the tiger, shouted, "Bring the Germans in." The German representatives brought their own pens so that they wouldn't have to use pens provided by the Allies. So that's just kind of a final touch of irony there, wouldn't you say, Scott?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of this, especially the symbolism, doing this in the Hall of Mirrors, it's pouring salt in the wounds. And I know that there are some like Clemenceau and those who've, or officers, generals who've seen men lost that really do want to stick it to them. But then there are others who realize what they're doing. And I want to read a few quotes from those people. Harold Nicholson, a British diplomat, said in 1919, "We are very stupid men. The treaties imposed upon our enemies were neither just nor wise." Princess Blücher, who was married into a German royal family, wrote in 1920, "Over and over, I heard the same refrain. We will hate our conquerors with a hatred that will only cease when the day of our revenge comes." So that's from the other side. Ferdinand Foch, the French marshal, said, this is the most famous quote from this period, "This is not peace. This is an armistice for 20 years. Very prophetic. And from the German side, obviously they're livid, but from the Deutsche Zeitung, the German newspaper, on the day the treaty was signed, there was an article that said, in general, the reparations owed by Germany were ratcheted down numerous times. But this didn't make them feel any better about it. They still felt like they were unjustly treated and they wanted revenge. Historian Sheldon Anderson says, "The Germans paid less in relative terms than the French did in 1871 following the Franco-Prussian War. But it wasn't the reparations that sank Germany's economy during the Great Depression of the early 1930s, but something more mundane. Germany's problems sprang mainly not from reparations, which really amounted to more than 3% of her gross national product, but from a tradition of high state spending, compounded by the welfare commitments of the Weimar government and the financial legacy of the Great War." So they did have to pay these reparations, and it partly had to do with what sank them and what led to World War II. But later on, still the feeling of disgrace that they're being consigned to a second-tier status among the nations of Germany is, I think, what sticks with them for decades afterwards. But this isn't the only treaty that's taking place here, because what you mentioned, James, is that there are numerous treaties with the different belligerents in World War I. So could you run through some of those different treaties and those different terms?
Sure, yeah. We're not going to spend near as much time on these as we did on Versailles, but we do need to discuss them. So first of all, you had the Treaty of Saint-Germain. This was with Austria, the new nation of Austria, much, much smaller than the Austro-Hungarian Empire had been. This was signed on September 10th, 1919, and it ceded territory to neighboring states and also forbade Austria from joining with Germany. As I mentioned previously, the Austrians really wanted to be part of the German nation, but, you know, Wilson always believed in self-determination, but not in this case. You know, self-determination has its limits. And again, it's understandable why, especially France, but also Britain, didn't want to have a combined German-Austrian republic, because it would be huge. Austria is not that big, but nevertheless, they felt it was better to keep the two nations separate. I should just sum up by saying the Austro-Hungarian Empire was divided into many pieces. You're going to have Austria, you're going to have Hungary. A big chunk of it becomes what's called the Kingdom of the Serbs, Croats, and Slovenes, which eventually becomes renamed as Yugoslavia. A big chunk of it goes to Romania. Some of it goes to Poland. And let's see, am I missing anybody? I think that's just about everybody. A couple little pieces go to Italy, but so that's the end of the once mighty Habsburg Empire. Speaking of Hungary, Hungary signed its own treaty with the Allies, the Treaty of Trianon. This is June 4th, 1920. Hungary gave up great amounts of territory to Yugoslavia, Czechoslovakia, and Romania. And I forgot Czechoslovakia, of course. How could I do that? I actually lived in Prague for a while. I should be ashamed. But Hungary's response to giving up all this territory was the slogan, "No, no, never." But you know, that's just a slogan. They could say that all they want, but they didn't have any power to do much about it. And this creates a big problem, because now you have this gigantic Romania, which is, I think, more than double the size it was before World War I. But Romania now has a bunch of Hungarians in it. So What are you going to do about that?
Well, yeah, I met a number of ethnic Hungarians from Romania in my PhD program. And once in a while, I would go to a store in Budapest, maybe a shopkeeper who was a Hungarian nationalist, and he would have a map of Greater Hungary, kind of thinking that, you know, maybe the political boundaries say this, but spiritually, this is what Hungary truly is.
Yeah, that problem has never been resolved right down to the present. All right. Third tree, the tree of Nui, and this is with Bulgaria, very, very much the junior partner of the Central Powers, but nevertheless, they did join and they needed to be dealt with. This is signed on November 27th, 1919, reduced the size of Bulgaria. Bulgaria ceded its Aegean coastline to Greece, which is a painful loss for them. Now they don't have an outlet to the Aegean. They ceded nearly all of its Macedonian territory to the Kingdom of Serbs, Croats, and Slovenes. And they had to give Dobruja back to Romania. The country had to reduce its army to no more than 22,000 men. That's a tiny army. And they had to pay reparations exceeding 400 million. Bulgarians call it the second national catastrophe. So Bulgaria gets trimmed down quite a bit. And then the fifth and final treaty. This is the Treaty of Sevres, and it's with Turkey. It's technically still the Ottoman Empire, I believe, at this time, right, Scott?
It is, yeah.
It doesn't really become the Republic of Turkey until, what, 23,
October 29th.
All right, I knew I could count on you for that. But needless to say, so even though after the Treaty of Sevres, it's still the Ottoman Empire, but it's going to be a much smaller Ottoman Empire. Turkey lost its Middle Eastern territory to Britain and France and lost land to Greece and Italy. And this treaty was not ratified by Turkey. In fact, they're going to completely repudiate it later. But most of its provisions were enforced by the Allies for a while, for a while. And there's a fascinating book on this, very complete, thorough story of this. The book is called A Peace to End All Peace, using that phrase that Scott quoted earlier, how Britain and France and I guess it was mainly Britain, but how France was a part of it too, how they cynically chopped up the Ottoman Empire and basically took over a big chunk of it and created what is now the modern Middle East. And that's totally stable, of course, right, Scott?
I know. They nailed it. I mean, the people who are within those nations have a long historical affinity to each other and makes perfect sense to me.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So they took a bad situation and made it worse.
Hey, everyone. Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
Did you want to add anything about the Treaty of Sèvres?
I think in the previous episode, the Battle of Megiddo, I saved the end of the Ottoman Empire and rise of the Turkish Republic there.
Yeah.
So if you want to go back to that, listeners, if you're curious what happens, but I'll just mention one short thing. Amongst the Ottoman, or we could say Turkish signatories to the Treaty of Sèvres, after the foundation of the Turkish Republic, they went to exile and were never allowed to return because there are things in the way history is taught in the Republic of Turkey, to a degree, with a certain degree of fairness, there's much pride in their history, but there's also a lack of confidence. There's an insecurity that Western nations are going to take advantage of us and we have to watch them. And some of that is based on historical facts. Some of that is paranoia, but they would point at something like the Treaty of Sèvres that look what they were trying to do. Look what they would have done. And for Turkey today, for those who push back heavily against some sort of Western action they think is unfair, they would think they're just trying to do another Treaty of Sèvres. They're always waiting in the wings to dismantle us. And I think for a lot of Westerners, they think, well, what are you talking about? But it's moments like these in their history that make something that happened in 1920 alive to them 100 years later.
Exactly. All right. So let's go ahead and wrap this up. We're going to talk about the League of Nations. The League of Nations began its existence in Geneva in January of 1920. But in the end, it failed because it did not have the power to enforce its decisions. The U.S. and the Soviet Union did not join the League of Nations. It's, I always find it ironic that the League of Nations was really President Wilson's brainchild. Excuse me. It was his baby, and his own country rejected it. It did not join. There were a lot of concerns about giving up U.S. sovereignty. A lot of senators and representatives, and as well as regular people, just were not interested at this time. The U.S. rejected the Versailles Treaty, and this is partly Wilson's fault. Wilson would not compromise on the structure of the league. I mean, Wilson was, it was his way or the highway, and he refused to even consider any modifications to the treaty. So the Senate rejected it. Wilson, before it was rejected, I should say, Wilson was trying to drum up support for it. So he went on a speaking tour all around the nation, traveled all across the country, making speeches, telling people to lobby their senators to vote for the treaty. But he really overdid it. Wilson, as we've talked about before, struggled with health issues his entire life, and he wore himself out completely. Eventually, he had a massive stroke, which rendered him incapacitated for several weeks. And I've seen it argued that the U.S. basically didn't even have a president from like October of 1919 until Wilson left office. Unless right. you count Edith.
Yeah, there's a book by William Hazelgrove called Madam President about this, and it's fascinating. Edith was not in favor of women's suffrage, yet she was arguably one of the nation's first presidents, and she doesn't have an elite background. I think she was a jeweler and met Wilson by happenstance. So there's sort of a Weekend at Bernie's type of scenario where they're pretending that Wilson has his faculties and his closest aides and his wife know what's happening. So they're the go-betweens between officials saying, could you have the president sign off on this? So they'll take the legislation to him. Maybe he can barely sign it. Maybe they do it for him and return it. And it's a very interesting period in history.
It's so fascinating. It's, you know, they didn't have the 25th Amendment back then, obviously. So if this happened today, of course, the vice president would take charge. But the vice president at the time had absolutely no power. He wasn't given any authority. I don't know if he even knew about Wilson's condition. He may have. It was a man named Thomas Marshall. But yeah, the U.S. was being run by Edith and a small, very small number of Wilson's closest advisors, not the cabinet, I should say. But anyway, that's a whole nother story. The fact of the matter is that Wilson did not have the capacity anymore to lobby for the treaty, and the treaty goes down in the Senate. Anyway, but the treaty was signed, of course, by Britain and France, and Germany was forced to sign it, and now the treaty had to be enforced. France felt like it was holding the tail of the tiger. So even the French, who were one of the driving forces behind the punitive measures in this treaty, realized this is not a good situation to be in. You know, we kicked Germany while they were down, but who's to say they're always going to stay down? Germany has a habit of not staying down. You know, to use a boxing analogy, you hit them with a right cross, they fall to the ground, and just when they get to about the count of eight, they rise up again and start slugging. But I will say, back to Wilson, Wilson was considered a hero by many in Europe, especially the Czechs. And when I lived in Prague, I was fascinated to notice that there was a square named after Wilson in Prague, right in the heart of Prague, the capital of the Czech Republic. It's Wilson Square is what it's called. And I believe there's other cities in Europe that also have things named after Wilson. All right, that's all I got. What do you got?
Well, I have a story. I was originally going to do it in the next episode, which is a shorter one, but talks about what happens to all of these different heads of state and generals. But I think it fits in this episode better because we're describing how there's a piece that's hammered out, but we can tell it is not a stable piece. With the humiliation of Germany, they're not going to take that line down. And there's so much of World War II that makes a lot of sense if you understand this piece, because many of the early actions are to try to atone for the past, to change what happened. And I want to just describe some things here of exactly what Adolf Hitler did to cleanse the shame of the German nation. And he was a corporal in World War I, and like many Germans, burned with anger at all these terms. He gets his revenge when he kicks off World War II. On June 22nd, 1940, Hitler, the corporal, he's now the Führer, and he's the dictator of the Third Reich, supreme commander of the Wehrmacht, and he's now dictating terms to France after their surrender when they invade France. Here's all the things that he does when he's dictating the terms, and I'm sure he has fresh in his mind the treaty at the Hall of Mirrors at the place where the German Empire was formed in 1871 and the humiliating symbolism World War One. Well, he's going to get revenge, and here's how he does it. So his destination is a railway car on tracks near the forest of Compiègne, France. It's the same railway car in which German representatives had agreed to the armistice of 1918. Hitler actually ordered the railway car removed from a museum, and engineers had to blow out a wall to get at it, and return to the exact same spot where the armistice was signed on November 11th, 1918. The site of the surrender, it was at the time a memorial commemorating France's victory, but he wanted to remake that into a site of German victory. When they came, a guard of honor from the SS was there to welcome him, and a monument of France's recapture of Alsace-Lorraine, which at the monument was an Allied sword plunged into the breast of a German eagle. It was obscured by a Nazi flag. But what wasn't obscured was a granite tablet that was inscribed the words, "Here on the 11th of November 1918 succumbed the criminal pride of the German Empire, vanquished by the free peoples which it tried to enslave." So Hitler read the inscription, and then for the news photographers there, he struck a fascist pose, which, if you're wondering what that is, it's part Superman. And CBS reporter William Schreer said, "He swiftly snaps his hands on his hips, arches his shoulders, plants his feet wide apart. It is a magnificent gesture of defiance, of burning contempt for this place now and all that has stood in the 22 years since it witnessed the humbling of the German Empire." And some other things about that scene. The railway car, which belonged to Field Marshal Ferdinand Foch, Hitler enters the railway car, and then he sat in Foch's chair. When the French delegates arrived, Wilhelm Keitel, who was the chief of the Oberkommando der Wehrmacht, he read out the preamble to the terms of the new armistice. And after Hitler heard that, then he left, and he didn't bother to listen to the rest of the terms dictated, because he knew the rest of them, but showing that, you know, "I don't even need to sit here because there's no argument here. You will be dictated to," saying that the way we are dictated to, I will do the same to you. Part of the terms is that Germany is going to occupy northern and western France, the entire Atlantic coast, with the occupation costs paid by French. And the new French government, centered on Vichy and led by a French hero of the First World War, Marshal Philippe Pétain, was a vassal state, as people know about Vichy France. And the war correspondent William Schreer noted that in 6 weeks, Hitler had achieved what Kaiser Wilhelm II had failed to do in more than 4 years of titanic battle. He summarized the event by saying, "The whole ceremony in which Hitler has reached a new pinnacle in his meteoric career and Germany avenged the 1918 defeat is over in a quarter of an hour." And Joseph Goebbels told Hitler afterwards, "The disgrace is now distinguished. It's a feeling of being born again." So all that to say, people held on to those feelings for a long time after World War One. And I'd like to think that they learned the lessons after World War II and did a much better job of creating a lasting peace. So if there's anything to be said for that, I mean, people were able to learn from their mistakes, but I wanted to throw that in. Anything else you want to add to this, James, before we wrap it up?
No, I'm good.
Okay.
We could go on for hours, but let's not.
Yeah, we always could, but yeah, sometimes you got to know when to quit. All right, well, that's all for this episode. In the next episode, we're going to be looking at what happens to the major players after the war. I think that covers it. That's all I have for today's episode. First off, I'd like to thank History Unplugged's Spy Masters, which you can easily become, and I'll explain what that is after listing them off. They are, in no particular order, Baron Fraser, Chris C., David Santee, Josh from VFW Post 2285, Jake Harrington, Josh Reddick, Jeff Mitchell, owner of Mountain West Commercial Las Vegas, Michael from New York, Michael Piccinetti, Nick Brooks, Rob from Chicago, Salvador Sanchez, Tom from Ohio, Moondoggy from Ohio, Bill Ivey, Bruce Ashby from Wire Meets Wood Guitars, WMWGuitars.com, Los, Sergeant Hooch, Sumo 41, and Willie from New Jersey. Now, having thanked my spy masters, I'd like to mention some ways you can get more involved with what I'm doing with History Unplugged. First, if you want to comment on the most recent episodes, you can check out the History Unplugged Facebook or YouTube page, which are video recordings of all the episodes, and they often come out before the audio episodes do. Second, please like and subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice. This helps the show grow and find new listeners. Finally, the best way you can get involved is to join History Unplugged's membership program called the Dalton's Rangers. This is the place where you can directly partner with me when it comes to the creation of the sorts of episodes I do, where I can most directly talk with you, the listener. I call it the Dalton's Rangers because they were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War. Go to patreon.com/unplugged and you can join at three levels. Join at the Scout level, you'll get early access to all new episodes and completely ad-free episodes, and I have about 500 by now. Join at the Intelligence Officer level. You get all the same stuff as level one, and you also get premium episodes. I'm doing a series on the life of Audie Murphy, on Americans who fought in World War I for the French Foreign Legion, and another series on Teddy Roosevelt's adventures in the Dakota Badlands. I have about 50 or so of these episodes now. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you get all the things from the first two tiers. You get a shout out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get three hardcover books, and you can ask me a question on absolutely anything in history, and I will devote an entire episode to answering it. So check out all those bonuses by going to patreon.com/unplugged. Listeners, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and see you next time.